be starting chapter 11 this morning. First 10 verses. See, I've entitled the message, The Motivation of Jealousy. If you have an outline, if you don't have an outline, look around, find you one, or raise your hand, we'll get you one or something. The Motivation of Jealousy. I'll tell you a little story that's I enjoy. Occasionally, I've been known to aggravate my grandkids. Try not to do that very often, but and one of the things that I enjoy, and Susan kind of have to work together to do it, and I think she enjoys it more than I do, and you'll see why in a minute, but all of our grandkids love their Nana. And I mean, she hung the moon as far as they're concerned, they're growing up. And there's about a 6 or 8 year span in there from about 2 years old to 10 or so that this will usually work. And, we'll be sitting around the house, everybody together, something, and I'll tell the grandkids, I'm going to get Nana sugar. And so I'll, you know, go up to Susan and start kissing her cheek and just kissing on her face, you know, and say, I'm getting Nana's sugar. I'm getting all Nana's sugar. And they don't have to be 2 or 3 years old, and you can see the fire kind of get in their eyes, you know, as they get a little jealous of me taking Nana's sugar. If they're real young, you know, sometimes they'll come and just sidle up, just get between my face and her face, you know, just get in there where I can't get to her. Or they'll push me away. They get a little older, they, you know, start beating on me, you know, and get rid of me. But jealousy, jealous of me showing affection to Nana. Jealousy is we look at it as a bad thing. We wouldn't call it a virtue. We would tend to call it a vice. But jealousy can be used, and even if it is totally a vice, and I'm just not sure, I would think the vast majority of the time it's something wrong there. But it can be used for a good thing, for a good purpose. Last week in John's message, the word was used in our text, the last part of chapter 10. It'll be used next week in his message. It's not used in my text, but I'm going to mention that word. We're going to read the first 10 verses of chapter 11 and then get into our point here. Chapter 11, verse 1, Paul says, I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not cast away his people which he foreknew. Know you not what the scripture says of Elijah, how he makes intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and dig down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what says the answer of God unto him? I reserve to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so then, at this present time also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if by grace, then it is no more works. Otherwise grace is no more grace. But if it be of works, then it is no more grace. Otherwise work is no more work. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeks for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. According as it is written, God has given him the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, unto this day. And David says, Let their table be made a snare, and a trap, and a stumbling block, and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened, that they may not see, and bow down their back always. In this text, it is continuing a thought that Paul has been giving us, all 10 chapters, obviously, but specifically chapters 8, 9, and 10. And now he's making an application, because the question probably would be coming to the Jews' mind that hear Paul, that read this letter. And it's about the covenant that God has with the Israelite people. I want you to think for a minute, and I've been trying to think in my own mind how this would work out for me. But I've got a question here. Living in a covenant culture, what is that like? I don't know. I don't know how the Jews feel about their relationship and their history and the covenant that they had and knew that they, or I should say have, with God. But I try to think of how I look at my national heritage. We grew up in school learning history, the history of the United States of America. We talk about the American Revolution. And at least when I was a kid in school, you were taught this history with a sense of pride, with a sense of feeling like, you know, I'm part of something. It was a great accomplishment, is the kind of impression I was instilled in me of what the founding fathers of our nation did and accomplished. They were heroes. They were great men. Their wisdom in putting together the Constitution that we live under was a marvelous thing. We also learn about the snares along the way, particularly the Civil War. And we learn all of these things, but still there is this built-in and instilled in me feeling that I live in the best place in the world. I am a citizen of the greatest nation on earth. I didn't merely come to that conclusion by thoughtful study. It was instilled in me. I was encouraged to think that way from my youth. Now, I don't know how similar that is to being an Israelite. I don't know how similar that is to being a Jew. I suspect it is similar in a way, but falls considerably short. Because I, as an American, can't go to the Scriptures and find some great things that God has said to the United States of America. They're not there. But Israelites can. Jewish people can. They have, beginning with Abraham, a covenant that God made with Abraham, that God would bless his seed forever. His seed would be as the sands of the sea, as the stars in the heavens. As a Jew, and I'm not one, but as a Jew, that would be my forefathers. That would be my ancestry. He's talking about my folks. That covenant is passed down to his son Isaac. Same thing. Not through Ishmael, but through Isaac. The same covenant was passed down to his son, Jacob. And Jacob's 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. Their children, their grandchildren, were, I think, for the most part, heavily indoctrinated with this sense of covenant. not just pride, but of who you are. This is who you are. You are special in God's eyes. There were some bad years. There were some bad leaders. God had told them, if you turn from me, this is what's going to happen. And it happened. They turned away and it happened. God reestablished that same covenant and even a little more, spelled it out a little greater when David was king on the throne and telling David that your kingdom will endure forever. Those kinds of promises were told to their children, to their grandchildren. And just a few hundred years later, they again turned away. The nation had a civil war. The nation split apart. And then they continued to turn away, and God led them into captivity, and it looked like that it was over. It looked like the nation of Israel was done. It was finished. But they were allowed to come back to Jerusalem. And for the next several hundred years, there was Israelites in Jerusalem. There was Israelites and Jewish people in Israel. But there was a lack of continuity. There's a lack of a settledness, a foundation for the nation. And they went through several hundred just dark years. And when Jesus came to this earth, and John the Baptist was born, and when John the Baptist lived, they were in those dark years. Rome had come to power, and the nation of Israel, like practically every other ethnic group around, lived under the heavy hand of Rome. They may have been allowed to kind of do their own thing as long as they didn't stir up strife toward Rome. But in any time Rome got a bee in their bonnet, they could come and put that heavy thumb up on them and get them back in line as far as what they wanted them to be like. And that kind of burden the Jewish people hated. I would too. They hated it. And they were always dreaming and thinking about this covenant that they had made with God, or that God had made with them. Looking for that everlasting kingdom that would sit on the throne in Jerusalem. And then the Apostle Paul comes on the scene. The Apostle Paul used to be one of them. But now he's preaching and teaching that this Jesus that they had crucified as a seditionist, they had crucified him violently and angrily, put him to death as a blasphemer. And now this man Paul is saying they had done wrong, that this indeed was their Messiah. And they begin to see not Jewish people embrace this Christ, but they begin to see Gentile people embrace this Christ. And if they thought for very long, the thought would surely at some point come to their mind, and they would entertain the thought of, what if he's right? If he is right, what does that say? That's saying that not only have we missed the Messiah, we've killed him, but we see all these Gentiles who to us in the past we looked at as dogs coming to this Christ, and the joy and the peace that is there. The question rises, it would come, has God turned away from us? Has God rejected us? Is God through with us? And that's the question that Paul again anticipates. How many times in the book of Romans have we seen Paul anticipate a question? Here it is again. Verse 1, has God cast away his people? In case you're wondering the answer, he tells us the answer. No, God forbid, no. And then he tells us four or five statements. We're going to go through these statements. The first one is this, that Paul himself is evidence that God has not totally cast away his people. Paul says, no, he hasn't cast away his people. I am an example. I am an example that he has not. I am of the seed of Abraham. I am an Israelite. I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. And I am a child of God. I am a Christian. He has not cast us away. The second thing that he says in the first part of verse 2, says, God has not cast away the people which he foreknew. Have we seen that word before? Foreknew. We saw it in chapter 8. And it doesn't mean, as it would commonly, you would commonly think it would mean, just facts. It doesn't mean just knowledge. It means a love, an affection that God had beforehand. God has not cast away the people which he set his affections upon. Remember, we saw that in chapter 8, verses 28 to 30. What else did we see from that context? That all of those that God foreknew, all of those that God set his affections upon prior to the foundation of the world, he did five or six other things. We saw in those verses. In order, those he foreknew, he predestined. Those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he glorified. Does it make sense to you that God would cast away someone that he is predetermined to conform to the image of his Son? No. What God has determined and decreed to take place will take place. And Paul says, God will not cast you away. If he foreknew you, God, those he foreknew. Then he gives an example. Does not the scripture say, when it talks about Elijah, he goes back to a story that is found, you can see in the handout here, in 1 Kings, three chapters, probably a little bit more on either side of those three chapters, but primarily in chapter 17 to 19. Ahab was king of Judah. Jezebel, his wife. Do you know anybody named Jezebel?
No.
There's a reason. There's a reason you don't know anybody named Jezebel. There probably are other names, but I don't know of any other name, man or woman, that I don't know anybody named but that. King and the queen. Elijah was a prophet during that time. And God told Elijah, go to Ahab and tell him that there's going to be a drought. That's not going to rain. And so he does so. And they're evil. And the people who would not worship Baal were likely to be persecuted, likely to be killed by Jezebel or Ahab. So most of the people who were, if you were going to be faithful to God, you kind of laid low. Elijah included. And there's another man, I don't know if he seems to be a prophet of some sorts, but he's accessible to Ahab. His name is Obadiah, and it's not the Obadiah that the book is in the Bible, a different Obadiah. And he's where the king can get a hold of him, you know, if he wants to. And they decide after it has not rained for a while that they need to do something to prompt the gods to let it rain. In the book of James, got that reference there as well, there's a verse that says this, that Elijah was a man of like passions as anybody, you and me. And this, I never really saw this for years. And it says, and he prayed that it would not rain. And it didn't rain for 3.5 years. What is Elijah praying? That it would not rain. It's not just that God has told Elijah that there's going to be a drought. But Elijah is praying that it would not rain. How would you like to have that task? After it's rained for 2 months. And then 6 months. And then a year. And things are dying. We're not talking about the grass dying. We're talking about trees dying. We're talking about livestock dying. We're talking about people who are hard-pressed to stay alive. And you're praying that it would not rain. I suspect Elijah didn't pray on the street corners. I suspect he was in his prayer closet with the door shut, the light out, in a whisper. At least that's the way I would want to do it. And there comes a day when King Ahab is wanting to find him. So he comes to Obadiah and he says, let's find Elijah. This is obviously a paraphrase. He says, you go this way and I'll go this way. Well, Obadiah finds him, or maybe Elijah finds Obadiah. I'm not sure which was the case, but their paths cross. And Elijah tells Obadiah, go and tell Ahab, and this is after the 3 or 3.5 years toward the end of it, go and tell Ahab to meet that God's going to send rain. Obadiah says, no, I'm not. Or he said, go tell Obadiah or Ahab to come here, and I'll talk to him because God's going to send some rain. And Obadiah says, no, I'm not going. Because as sure as I leave you here and go to find Ahab to bring him back to you, we're going to come back here, and guess what? You're going to be gone. God's going to haul you off somewhere else, and I'm going to tell Ahab, here he is, and we're going to come here, he's nodding, he's going to kill me. I'm not doing it. And Elijah talked him into doing it, so he does it. And you know the account, one of the greatest stories that are in the Old Testament accounts of God showing his power. They get all the prophets of Baal, I think there's 450 of them, get them together, and they're here. And Elijah is here. And the prophets of Baal are going to go first. They're going to call out on Baal to consume with fire from heaven and consume their offering and be pleased with them and send rain. And so they begin to call in the morning, early in the morning. And they call, and nothing happens. And they keep calling. And they begin to get in a frenzy of a dance and to cut themselves and to do all kinds of things to try to entice Baal to answer them. And this is the part I like. Elijah begins to mock them. He says, you know, maybe he's asleep. Yell louder. Maybe he can't hear you. Maybe he's talking to somebody. And he just can't hear you. You know, yell louder. Or maybe he's gone on a trip. Mocking them. And they spend all day, up until the evening, wearing themselves out, trying to get Baal to answer them. Nothing happened. Well, Elijah, his turn. The first thing he does is calls for the people to bring 4 barrels of water. Do you know how valuable water was to them at that time? I'm not sure where they got it, where it came from, but I'm imagining there were some people there that were a little reluctant to waste this good water and pour it on this altar. But they do it. They soak it, wet it down with these 4 barrels of water. He says, go get 4 more. They soak it, wet it down, go get 4 more. 12 barrels of water they soak this place down with. And then Elijah prays. And God consumes the altar, the fire, the heat licks up the water that's poured all around the place and consumes it. And the people, fickle as they are, cry out, the Lord, He is God. And they kill 400 and something prophets of Baal. Assassinate them, kill them, take their lives. Jezebel is not there. But she soon hears, because God told Elijah, tell Ahab, head for home. Because you're going to get caught in the rain if you don't get gone. You know, I'm leaving out a few things. But he heads for home, he goes home, gets to home, and Jezebel's there. She hears what's happened. She says, before I will kill that guy, before the day is up, he will die. She's angry at Elijah. Even though it's raining, Elijah, after seeing all this, runs and hides. That's the part that puzzles me. He runs and hides. He is in fear of his life because he's afraid of this woman, Jezebel. God comes to him and says, Elijah, what are you doing here? He's hiding in a cave somewhere, I believe. He says, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm the only one left. I'm the only one left. And she's trying to kill me too. Leave out a little bit more. God tells him, he says, Elijah, I have 7,000 people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. 7,000. Is that a lot? Depends on your perspective. Depends on what you're comparing it to, don't it? How many people lived in the nation of Israel at that time? I don't know. But I would suspect it was in the millions. If a couple million came out of Egypt into Canaan, and that was several hundred years prior to this, I would imagine it's maybe 5, 10, 15 million people. Compared to that, 7,000, not very many. It's not very many. But God doesn't need very many, does he? He doesn't need any. And here, in our text today, Paul is answering the objection, has God cast away his people? He says, I'm an Israelite. Don't you remember what Elijah told God? I'm the only one. And yet God said, no, I have 7,000 people. Do you ever feel like that you're the only one? I can't say that I feel like I'm the only one. Sometimes I get discouraged. Sometimes I get depressed. I've never felt like I was the only one. But sometimes I look at the things that goes on around us. Sometimes I look at this America that was instilled in me that was so great, and I see the direction that it's headed, and I'm thinking, we are the only ones. That our numbers are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and the restrictions and the anger is more and more heated, directed at us. And yet, that's nothing to God. God tells Paul, I have 7,000 people who have not bowed their knee to Baal. And he says in verse 5, even so, he brings it to the present time, even so, at this present time, there is a remnant where? Within the nation of Israel. There is a remnant there that are mine. How does he say that? There is a remnant according to the election of grace. There is a remnant there that are mine. I have set my hand upon them. I have sealed them. They are mine. I will not cast them out. They are mine. Not every Israelite, but there are some that are his. Number four, Israel is blinded by dependence on works. He brings in verse 6 and 7 there, or verse 6. That seems to be almost a different subject, but it's not. He's giving us explaining to us where Israel is as a whole. And it's not just Israel, it's every religion that's on the face of the earth, except for Christianity. Here's where the Israelites were. If it's by grace, if the remnant are mine by grace, then it is no more of works. And he just makes a comparison between grace and works. It's either got to be one or the other. It's either got to be works or it's got to be grace. If it's works, it's not grace. If it's grace, it's not works. That's just basically what he's saying in verse 6 there. And the Israelites, just like every other group you can name just about, were trying to do things. They had all of these rituals, all these lists of things, things that they had to hold on to and do in order to please God. And they were depending on those things. For them, it might have been circumcision. For them, it might have been the Feast of the Passover. For them, it might have been this and that and this and that. For us, we have different lists, don't we? But we have lists. For some, and I shouldn't say us, the world today, Christianity as a whole, you will find groups who depend upon their ability to do certain things in order to gain merit with God. What does Paul say? Look in verse 7. I'm going to ask some questions here that are on the outline. It says, what then? Think about this, he says. Israel hath not obtained that which it seeked for. What was it that Israel as a whole is seeking for? The same thing you and I seek for, salvation. They are seeking for salvation. They are seeking to be pleasing to God. Did they obtain it? No. As a whole, the Israelite nation did not obtain it. Why did they not obtain it? Because they were seeking it through works. Who did obtain it? The elect. It was obtained, the remnant, or we could say the remnant attained it. The remnant obtained it. How did they obtain it? By the election of grace, he says in these verses. Was it anything they did to obtain it? No. It was something God did, and it was only something God did. What happened to the others? Look in verse 7. What happened to the rest? Well, I'm going to make you answer me. They were blinded. The rest were blinded. How were they blinded? God blinded them. You remember 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, we talked about in chapter 9 some tough stuff. Where Paul says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, where Paul said, God is the potter. We're the clay. Who are we to talk to God and say, why have you made me thus? And I gave you a list, a short list. It wasn't an exhaustive list by any means. And the point was to show you this is not just unique with Paul. This hard stuff that God would blind someone's eyes to keep them from seeing. That he would make their ears dull of hearing to keep them from hearing. Now, I was showing you that this was not just something Paul came up with. I gave you quotes from Jude that said the same thing. I gave you quotes from Peter, 1st or 2nd Peter, that said the same thing. I gave you a verse from Proverbs, where the writer of Proverbs, Solomon perhaps, said the same thing. From the Gospel of John, where the Apostle John said the same thing. And I made the comment that if we're going to shut Paul up, we've got to shut up all these other people too. If we don't like what Paul says, then you're not going to like what 5 or 6 other writers of the Bible says either. You remember that? Here's two more. Two more. Look in verse 8. According as it is written. Where is it written? The Old Testament. Who wrote it? Isaiah. This is a quote from Isaiah, so I'll add him to our list. God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, ears that they should not hear, unto this day. Now that's not, at the time that's written, that's not talking about 2018. That's talking about when it was written there, in whatever that is, 50 or 60 AD. Paul is saying, Isaiah mentioned this, that God would give the Israelite people a spirit of slumber, eyes that wouldn't see the truth, ears that wouldn't hear the truth, they wouldn't want to hear the truth. He says, unto this day. That was 500 or 600 year period there. And as I think I heard Carol mention, that blindness may yet be there as a whole on the nation of Israel. Would God do such a thing? They asked, remember we talked about that? They asked that very question in Romans 9. And what was Paul's answer? Who are you to question God? Be careful how you question God's behavior. Here in chapter 11, he quotes Isaiah. In verse 9, he quotes David. This is from the Psalms. David says, let their table, or this is from a psalm David wrote, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see. Bow down their back always. So we add David to that list. In Paul's day, the relationship between Paul and the Jewish people as a whole, the Israelite people as a whole, between the Christian church, between God, all of this relationship and all of these things, it appears from this text is this way. That God, in His good pleasure, for His own purposes, that we may never understand, blinded the eyes, for the most part, of the Israelite nation, so that they would not see. And yet, within that group, He had His own people, a remnant. And God used primarily the Apostle Paul, but He used this period, this time of blindness, that the gospel might be preached and believed and spread throughout the world through another people, the Gentiles. That's me. That's you. It's been that way for almost 2,000 years. He said last week, John will probably talk about this a little bit next week, that one thing that's going to happen is that the Israelite people, in some way, and I don't comprehend this, in some way, God's going to use the way things are now, the way things were when Paul was writing this, to provoke his people that he has not forsaken, even though it may look like it, to provoke them to jealousy. And they will, in some way and somehow, they will turn again to him. That's been the case, it looks like, for centuries. We see it here in chapter 11. John picked this up next week. Let's pray. Father, I acknowledge that my understanding is so prone to be suspect. I can't comprehend things without a framework of time. I can't comprehend omniscience. I can't comprehend infinity. I can't comprehend foreknowledge. But I can read. And I see what you say. God, I accept your word as your word. God, would you bring glory to yourself? Bring glory to your name through all that you have ordained, through all that you have proclaimed, through all that you have purposed. Would you make your name known? Would you make your power known? God, honor yourself. Amen.